Welcome to Youth Speaks Out, a show by, for, and about young people. It airs on the first Sunday of each month from 3 to 4 p.m. and is hosted by young people in Mendocino County. We want to create a place where young people can talk truthfully about important issues in our lives and have a dialogue with a community of listeners. Today's hosts are me, Rowan, and...
Kelsey.
Heaven.
Christina.
And we all attend Laytonville High School.
Today we will cover two topics. First, we will listen to excerpts from a recent public forum in Laytonville on youth and drunk driving. Students at Laytonville High School had the same presentation earlier in the day as part of our annual health day. Another workshop we attended on that day was on birth control. That will be our second topic today. The presentation on youth and drunk driving was made by California Highway Patrolman Mike Majors. He described many aspects of using alcohol and driving a vehicle. He covered the legal ramifications of getting a DUI, driving under the influence, as well as why it is dangerous and why teens are more susceptible to the negative driving effects.
At the public forum, Candy Muzio, a chemical dependency counselor from the Long Valley Health Clinic, also spoke. She explained how the teen brain is not fully developed and cannot process alcohol in the same way an adult can. Also, youth do not have the experience to be able to recognize their own motor impairment when under the influence of alcohol. She also described neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to physically adapt to patterns of behavior. So we will now listen to Officer Mike Major and Candy Muzio at the public forum in Laytonville on youth and drunk driving.
So the presentation is on underage drinking and driving, and also just drinking and driving in general. My name is Michael Major. I go by Mike. I work out of the Garberville CHP office. DUI, way back in the day, like we were talking, it wasn't as seen as quite a problem or as much of a problem. In the early 1980s, groups began to form. One in particular was MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Most of us probably know what it is, but they have victim assistance to help victims that have been injured in DUI-related incidents. And what their goal was when they first started was to lower the average yearly death toll. And that average death toll was 21,000 deaths a year nationally. Due to the awareness and the stricter laws, that death toll has fallen to around 10,000 deaths a year nationwide. That's still a lot. That's way more than we need to have. In California alone, so me and my partner went to the MAD ceremony in June of this year in Sacramento, and they had 734 pairs of shoes around the room it was in, and ranging from baby shoes all the way up to, you know, shoes we would wear. And each one of those shoes was for a person who lost their life in a DUI collision in the state of California in 2012. DUI is most commonly associated with alcohol use and driving. DUI is driving under the influence of a drug. And in law enforcement terms, when we talk about drinking and driving, a vehicle involved, a drug is any substance, when taken into the human body, can impair the ability of a person to operate a motor vehicle safely. So it's a pretty broad term. It can be anything from cough syrup to marijuana, Xanax, alcohol, and all the other hard drugs we know about. Prescription drugs. One in three people will be involved in a drunk driving crash in their lifetime. Car crashes are the leading cause of death for teens, and about a quarter involve an underage drinking driver. The DUI, both a felony and misdemeanor, apply at any age. It basically is if you're in a motor, those two apply if you're in a motor vehicle and under the influence. For people under 21, you have the zero tolerance laws, where you can't drive with a measurable amount of alcohol in your system. If it's less than 0.04% blood alcohol, it would be the vehicle code section 23136. If it's 0.5 and under 0.08, you'd be in violation of 23140. Those two sections, you get the underage person would get cited for it. Most of the time it's taken to a responsible party and the car will be towed because we don't want it being given back to that person any time in the night. So, and two, those violations will carry a penalty for the person under 21. They will lose, their license will be suspended for a year or more, depending on previous violations and what they do or don't do while they're with us. And then two, any person under 21 cannot possess alcohol in a car unless they're supervised by a person of age. So their parents with them or an adult and they're going somewhere to a barbecue, they can have it. But if someone under 21 years of age is driving around with a six-pack in their car unopened in the trunk, they can get cited for a violation. And the alcohol would be taken in as evidence. Another law, too, a DUI does apply on a bicycle. It applies, there's a separate section for that. There's also a separate section for the motorized scooters. Pocket bikes you can get a DUI on, anything with a motor pretty much. Quads, motorcycles, you can get DUI on a horse. So besides the court penalties and the possible costs, you have vehicle towing, which is around $200 an hour for most of the tows we're contracted with. That's from when the time they leave their house to the time they return for most of the guys around here. And then you have court fees. All these fees were received from local attorneys, insurance office, and then I got other ones off the DMV website. But these are for first-time offenders with low BACs and with no other circumstances that would cause it to be more. Higher BACs will up the rate, priors will up the rate, and depending on how much you want to fight it in court is how much you're going to pay your attorney for. Court fees, like I said, are $2,900 and up. Attorney fees, $2,500 or more, just for basics. Insurance fees will be doubled for 3 years, and the loss of the good driver discount for 10 years. And that's if your insurance company even keeps you. Some of the companies that are more well-known will just drop you completely and tell you to go elsewhere. DUI offender programs for first time can be anywhere from $300 to $1,660. That's a lot based off of whether you do chemical tests, whether you, what's your BAC. If you have multiples, it can go up a lot from there. And it can be anywhere from like an 8-hour course to like more of a month long where you have to go all the time. Then DMV-wise, for anyone over 21, driving privilege will be suspended for a full 30 days at least. If they apply for it, you could get a 4-month restricted license to drive to and from work. If there's refusals or high BACs, you could lose your driving privilege for longer.
My name's Candy Musio. I'm a chemical dependency counselor for Long Valley Health Center. And I was asked to attend, partly for my own edification, I've never attended a presentation by CHP before, and to address teenage drinking and driving from a little bit more of a treatment and medical perspective. We recognize that teenagers, their brains do not develop until they're 21 years of age. The cerebral cortex of your brain is in the front part of your head, and it is the very first thing that's impaired by alcohol or any other drug. And medically speaking, alcohol is a drug. It impacts your abilities. Since theirs is not fully developed and won't be until they're 21, executive function, the ability to regulate behavior, the ability to connect cause and effect, the ability to multitask, as the CHP was pointing out, to do more than one thing at a time, is not fully developed. If that young person puts alcohol into their system, they're not able to process it as well as someone who is 21 years of age or older, not because they're lacking in any way, it's simply developmentally they're not fully grown yet. The same is also true for other internal organs. Your body has to metabolize anything that you put in it. When teenagers drink, they're also frequently using other substances, and it overloads their system. Social drinkers are a unique group of people. They don't like the effects of alcohol. That's why you're not arresting them, because as soon as they start to feel the effects, they don't like that feeling. A social drinker, according to the American Psychological Association, drinks 1 to 3 ounces per occasion. An ounce being a beer, a glass of wine, a shot, a mixed drink counts as one. No more than 3 per occasion. No more than 3 to 6 times per year. At 2 to 3 ounces, they're not impaired. As soon as they start to become impaired, they don't like the feeling, they don't finish their beverage. They don't like that. Teenagers, because they don't have executive functioning, because they don't haven't had the life experience to process and understand what is normal for them. If you're in, like Officer Majors was pointing out, if you're an adult and you drink socially, you know that that 2's my limit. I start to get a little foolish after 2. Some people 3, some people 1. But as an adult social drinker, you know your limit. Teenagers don't have that life experience. They don't know their limit. And they, as you pointed out, want to be cool. And if this person is drinking 4 shots, then I'm going to drink 5. And they encourage each other, unaware that each shot they're drinking is 1 ounce and their body can't process it. That's why alcohol poisonings, when someone is admitted to the emergency room for alcohol poisoning, 82%, it might be 85%, over 80% of the time it is an underage drinker, someone under 21 years of age, simply because their body does not have the ability to process alcohol the way a full-grown adult does. And then, Lindsay, you reminded me that I also wanted to mention about neuroplasticity. All the little TV ads are happening right now. And a lot of that research was actually done to study Alzheimer's and dementia and how to prevent that. And in that process, we learned a lot about how the brain works and how the wiring happens, especially for teenagers and young adults. And what we now know is that sports are fabulous. Any organized activity, whether it's being athletic, creative, dance, drama, any of those things are fabulous for kids, and we want to support those because we have learned that your brain is like a computer being programmed, and between the ages of 12 and 17, it's literally wiring how to access chemicals, the so-called feel-good chemicals, serotonin, dopamine, epinephrine, norepinephrine. And those experiences, the easiest way to remember it is neurons that fire together, wire together. And now it's hardwired in your brain. And if you have hardwired this activity with a release of endorphins or with a release of serotonin, it's just like a lab rat. You will continually go back to that over and over and over to get that same experience. That's why people who get that release either from sports, dance, music, fine arts, community service. Community service actually boosts serotonin levels. We've done studies that if you do a kindness for someone else, your serotonin level increases, the recipient's serotonin level increases, and more amazingly, anyone who witnessed that kindness, their serotonin increases. It's a natural high that gets handed through. So community service is huge. Donating time and energy to others really does help people feel better.
That's
on a chemical level in their brain, as well as just a general good feeling, and it's contagious. People who are happy and healthy and well-adjusted, not stressed, don't tend to not reach outside themselves to alter how they feel. They don't need it.
That was CHP Officer Mike Major and Cindy Muzio from Long Valley Health Center speaking at the Laytonville Public Forum on Youth and Drunk Driving. Let's go around the group and describe what we learned and what surprised us during Mike's presentation at the Health Day.
Well, I thought it was interesting how he was describing that you could, he told us that you could get a DUI from being on your own property and drinking alcohol and driving a vehicle. I thought that was interesting. I've never heard that before. And he also said that if you were to crash a four-wheeler on your own property while under the influence, you could also get a ticket or something like that. It's just never crossed my mind that it would be any sort of thing on your own property.
Well, I found out that you can actually get a DUI while on a bicycle. That was extremely surprising. So, I mean, I guess the best thing for you to do is if you are out partying, you either leave your keys and stay where you are, you call a taxi, you have a designated driver, but don't go out on a scooter, don't go out on a bike, because that is illegal.
Also, I found out that it was interesting you could get a DUI on a horse. I mean, if you think about it now, I understand why it's like that, because you're also driving a horse, I guess. And they do listen to you, so they could do silly things with you behind the reins.
Sort of the same. I really learned, I never even thought about being drunk on a horse, and I never thought that people would go out and ride their horses drunk, let alone get arrested for it. It makes me sort of wonder, is it illegal to use rollerblades while drunk? Can you ride around on rollerblades and stuff like that? I mean, you can't ride a scooter, you can't ride a bicycle, horses even. It's
pretty sure you can skateboard, so rollerblades might be under the same category as skateboarding.
I have a question. What if the horse is the inebriated one?
I think you'd probably get in trouble for something along the lines of animal cruelty for getting a horse drunk, because, you know, doesn't really go through their, as far as I'd guess, probably wouldn't go through their systems very well.
Well, I've heard that if horses drink beer, then they're a good horse. I mean,
point taken.
It's also sort of interesting. I mean, if you want to ride a car, or you want to drive a car, you have to have a driver's license. And if you drive said car without a driver's license and get caught, you're screwed for however long and lose the possibility to get a license for a while. But you can ride a horse without a license. Who knows if you're capable of riding a horse or not? And you could ride a bicycle without a license. A bicycle I can sort of understand because, you know, everyone rides bikes. From little kids to adults to, like, tons of people. Bikes are everywhere. They're a great way to get around and great way to have some exercise, and they're fun. But horses, yeah, they're great as well, but dangerous. And I don't know. I think it'd be interesting if there was some slight regulation or something like that on who could ride a horse. If you'd actually need to know how to ride a horse to be able to ride said horse.
I know from personal experience that it is a lot more difficult to ride a horse than it looks like. I almost got hit by a car. Several, actually. Because I'm not very experienced in driving horses, I guess.
Well, most people who also have horses, though, know how to ride them. You're not just going to go out and buy a horse on a whim, usually.
Well, you know, when you're intoxicated, everything sounds like a good idea, so.
From riding while drunk to buying a horse while drunk and riding that around.
Not necessarily buying a horse, but hopping on a horse and deciding to ride it around.
And so, stealing a horse?
Maybe.
Maybe riding a friend's horse.
That too.
I mean, who knows? It's like, hey man, we're all drunk. Let's go ride that guy's horse. That just sounds preposterous, but I mean, who knows? It's probably happened at least once or twice.
So here's a question. Do youth in our community drive while drunk?
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say I've seen several youth in our community driving while intoxicated. Once at the store, I actually saw one getting pulled over, and he was fairly drunk. And my mom offered to drive his car home for him since he was already getting in trouble. But yeah, it was bad.
Well, I mean, I don't suppose our community is any different from anybody else's. Like, we all have the drug problems, the teen pregnancy problems, and we have our fair share of drunk drivers. And a big portion of those drunk drivers are people who are under the age of 21.
Because they usually can't handle the alcohol as well as older people might be able to. They don't know their limits, like Mike was saying on the excerpt.
Is it that, or I sort of think that it could be that a lot. It probably is. But there's also that younger people, they really want to show off. That's what I think is one of the really big things, is the back to the thing about what Mike was saying on the excerpt. It was, okay, that guy did 4 shots, I'll do 5. And then the next guy does 6. It just escalates. So whereas when you might be an adult and you might be able to say, okay, this guy did 4, I know that if I do any more than 3, I'm going to be screwed up. Then you know what you're getting yourself into. But a lot of young people could be their first time drinking, or they could be drinking something new, or it could be something entirely new to them in so many different ways that they underestimate the effects and just say, screw it. Might as well have some fun, see what happens.
And it impairs your judgment, so things that you'd usually think that's not a good idea to do, you're like, oh, well, whatever, I'll drive. Sounds fun.
Gotta get home, gotta take somebody somewhere, gotta do something.
It'll be just like a video game, you know, playing Grand Theft Auto.
And the worst part is a lot of your friends really will tell you, hey, don't get behind the wheel, don't pick up your keys, stay where you are. But what it is every young person has some form of a superiority complex. So when you tell them not to do it, they're going to try and be superior and show you that they can do it. And that's one of the big problems. You tell me I can't do it, and I'm going to do it.
It's one of the reasons that I believe, not necessarily saying that it's a bad thing, but giving the facts about it is so much more important. You're teaching them about how to drive safely and teaching them why it's a bad idea to drive drunk versus saying, no, it's a bad idea, don't do it. If you put all your time and effort into just saying that it's a bad idea, people will want to be the rebel. They'll want to be, look, I'm cool. I can drive while drunk. And that's plainly stupid and dangerous.
Young people oftentimes feel invincible, like they can't get hurt, but they can also hurt other people. And, well, they can hurt themselves, too.
It's also a trust thing, too. You trust fully in yourself. And when you're drunk or when you're under the influence, that trust is amplified. So it always comes down to, I'm not going to be the one in a car wrecked. I'm not going to take this turn too fast and flip this car. It's always, you have so much trust in yourself, whether you're inebriated or not, that you take the chances because you don't think that you're going to be one of the statistics. You're not going to be one of those underage drinkers who gets in a car wreck and kills yourself or your friends or hurts or wounds anyone else. It's never going to be you.
Yeah, it's a lot of people always think, oh, sure, that other guy did it. He must have been doing something wrong. But when I do it, I will do it right. Because I saw what this guy did, and I know not to make that mistake. And then you get drunk, and then you're driving your car, and then you do the same thing that person did, but worse, and everything goes wrong. There's so many possibilities. It's extremely dangerous.
You could also decide one time that you're going to do it, you're going to drive, and it'll be fine. And it was fine, and you didn't, and nothing happened. So then you think, now I can do it every time, and nothing's going to happen since I did it once, and it was fine. And then it's not fine, and then you get in an accident and hurt someone, yourself.
Or even just getting caught. That's definitely a big thing as well. You might not be hurting anyone, but screws up your life pretty bad.
Let's reintroduce ourselves. I'm Kelsey.
Heaven.
Christina.
And Rowan.
We all attend Laytonville High School. As we said at the beginning, we have two topics today. We will now talk about birth control. Another workshop we attended at the health fair was on birth control. At the health fair, Corinne Palmer from Planned Parenthood gave a presentation on sexual health. She covered safer sex, STIs, sexually transmitted infections, and birth control options for teens. She also informed the students about resources in our county where youth can receive confidential and free services related to sexual health. The class talked about how important healthy communication is in relationships. Students shared what they thought about the expectations and pressures around sex. They talked about gender role expectations and orientation. Sexual health includes talking about behavior changes to keep a person safe, access to services, education about what works and what doesn't.
There are plenty of myths out there. Where can we find the facts? There are family-packed, funded health centers in many of the communities that we live in. It is important to know where a young person can get confidential and free services. Many young people are sexually active, which exposes them to the possibility of pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections, or STIs. That is the term used now instead of sexually transmitted diseases, or STDs. In our workshop, we heard about the current birth control methods, including condoms, which can also prevent the spread of STIs. The rates of teen pregnancy in California has been steadily decreasing for the past 2 decades. The rate of teens giving birth has also dropped to a record low, with experts crediting more comprehensive sex education and the availability of health services. And this is at a time when some Republicans in Congress are shutting down the federal government. One of their demands is that all funding on a federal level for birth control must cease.
72% of teen pregnancies are unintended. The birth rate among teenagers reached another historic low in 2012, government research announced Friday, and there is evidence that a switch to more effective means of birth control is a factor. According to the National Center for Health Statistics at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or the CDC, the birth rate among young women ages 15 to 19 fell 6% last year to 29.4 births per 1,000, the lowest rate in 73 years the government has been collecting the data. The decline was across all racial and ethnic groups.
Pediatrician Dr. John Santali, a professor of population and family health at Columbia University, has studied those and other survey results. There is not much evidence of a change in abortion use and not much change in sexual activity since 2003, says Santali. For example, the percentage of high school kids reporting ever having sexual intercourse was about 54% in 1991. According to the new CDC survey, this rate declined through 2002 and then held steady at about 47% through 2011, the last year of available data. What we have seen is greater availability of much more effective birth control methods, says Santali. While condoms use increased substantially in the 1990s and early 2000s among high schoolers, is actually declined slightly after that, according to the CDC survey. At the same time, medical professionals have increasingly been recommending the IUD, a small plastic device that is inserted and left inside the uterus to prevent pregnancy, says Santali. While it does not protect against sexually transmitted diseases, it can be used in combination with a condom, which does offer such protection.
We are now going to discuss our topic, birth control, for about 20 minutes. Then we will open the phone line for your questions, comments, and insights. The purpose of this show is to engage the community in listening to young people speak about what is happening in our lives. We believe that your input is equally important in creating connections between youth and adult population. We are at the Willits Studio, and our phone number will be 707-456-9991. So let's go around and describe something we learned about learned from the presentation on birth control. I, for one, heard a lot about the different types of birth control. There's so many out there that it seems ridiculous that people wouldn't be using it if they were going to have sex. There's patches, rings, shots, IUDs. I mean, there's pretty much something for everybody who
wants to get on some sort of birth control.
And birth control isn't all about, like, shots or pills or condoms or anything. There are different forms. Like, abstinence is actually a form of birth control. So is the rhythm method, finding your actual time of the month rhythm and having sex at the times that you are not ovulating.
I never knew there were so many different types of birth control, and I'd never really thought about it. I thought, okay, well, I've heard about the pill, I've heard about condoms, and I guess I heard once or twice someone talking about shots, but having all the information readily available and being told exactly what everything was, where you could get it, and how it worked on the body emotionally and physically was extremely interesting. It's a lot of information that I feel more youth in the community and more youth around the world would really benefit from. It takes a different step on teaching. It takes it to more of a, okay, here is everything that you could do to make it as safe as possible for yourself to have sex, versus what it always seems like we're taught in school, which is, okay, sex can be really dangerous, you don't want to do that. And, you know, I've heard a lot of people say that one of the reasons that they don't want people teaching about sex on a factual level is that it encourages youth to go out and have sex, whereas it seems like it doesn't do the opposite, but it tells those that are already having sex that, okay, here's what you can do to make sure that you're not endangering yourself and others, and that's a really big thing.
One of the reasons there are so many different types of birth control is because it affects everyone differently. Like, some women, with pills, they can get weight gain and serious migraines, and some even get sick from it. And so they have to have different methods for everyone, so that different methods that will suit them better.
And the thing with it, through the Planned Parenthood thing, is that you can get it free. You don't have to tell your parents if you're being sexually active. If you're afraid of them finding out or anything, then there's still ways to cover yourself. And some people don't like that because they think that, oh, I can hide it from my child is hiding this from me. I have the right to know. I should be able to know. But sometimes it's not always needed. And having free condoms around is a good thing. I mean, most people who are having sex should be able to go out to the clinic and say, hey, I need some free condoms. Where are they located? And I think the ones in the Laytonville clinic are located in the bathroom or something like that.
Yeah, they are. Also, it's not so much like that you can hide it from your parents either. There's also the just being able to trust that when you go to the doctors to get tested or to get birth control or to get the Plan B, which is a morning after pill, that what you're going in for won't be expressed to your parents, to your friends, whoever you're living with. And you have the option of giving your phone number, and if anybody besides you picks up, they won't talk to them. So it's all about, what would you call it?
Trust and confidentiality?
Confidentiality. That's what it is. It's being able to trust that when you go in for something like this, which can be very uncomfortable for some people, like if you're afraid you might have an STI, you go in, you get tested, and you don't want everybody to know that you're doing that. So it's all about confidentiality. You want to make sure that your secrets are being kept safe and that they are expressly that. They are yours.
There's also the concern of sexual abuse, and that's a reason why some people might choose to do it without the consent of their parents. If there's some kind of bad thing going on that they're ashamed of, or that's even being caused at home, they are protecting themselves, and it doesn't need to be known by other people. It could be something just between you and your doctor, and that's a very important thing, and just taking it away, like I guess the Republicans are trying to, is a bit ridiculous.
I can't see why anyone would want to remove the possibility of federally funded healthcare. Or not healthcare, but birth control. It's such a big thing for so many people. I mean, I have a friend who said, hey man, I really want to get some condoms and stuff. I wanted to have sex, but I don't have any money for it. So I said, hey, you can get them at the clinic. And he said, oh, look, I'm a little bit afraid to do it. Can you do it for me? That's sort of where I'd say, no, that's up to you. This is your thing. It's your life. You might not be able to afford it, but they're free here and you can go get them. You should go do it yourself. Otherwise, if you're not mature enough to say, hey, I need to get some condoms, where are they? Then you probably shouldn't be having sex.
I completely agree with that. If you can't go and get them yourself from the clinic, you shouldn't be having sex yet.
Exactly. It's not even like you're going in and saying, okay, hey, I have this much money, how many condoms could I get? It's completely free, and you just go in and you say, hey, where are the condoms? Or could I get some free condoms? You're getting them for free to help protect yourself and others, and it's an amazing ability to be able to do that. I'm sure that there are people all over the world that wish they had that possibility, and taking that away from the citizens in America is dangerous.
I also believe that Healthy Start in Laytonville provides condoms, I'm pretty sure. I know they do at events like prom and stuff.
And I know that you can talk to somebody through Healthy Start to get a backdoor
appointment?
Appointment, yeah, that's what it is. So if you don't even want to go through the clinic in case you might see somebody that you know, they'll let you in through the back of it, and you can make a confidential appointment, and you can even go in with somebody like Jema or Rachel or some of the other people there and talk to, so you're not alone, but you're doing it confidentially.
Okay, so here's another one. What kind of birth control are you most familiar with?
Most common thing that I've ever heard of is condoms. That is the most publicly known and most out there thing. I mean, most people have probably heard some of those funny little slogans like, wrap it before you tap it, things like that, to promote condom use. It's funny, and it promotes people thinking about condoms, which is, you know, pretty important. And that's what I've always heard about the most.
And probably for female consumption would be like the pill is the most widely known one for females. And there's so many other ones. It's
the pill, you know, you take one pill every day. And I'm pretty sure they have some different types that you take it once a week. They also have patches that you can put on. And I think you change them
once a week.
Once a week?
Yes.
And there's like implants and shots and
it's all sorts of different stuff that you can do. I mean, there's so many different things, so many industries that are built just around birth control. And I mean, birth is such a big thing. Teens get pregnant everywhere, and cutting down on that a little bit to make sure that people are staying in school versus having to take care of a kid is pretty important.
The thing I really enjoy learning about the most with from Corinne and everybody else with the sexual health is that they're not exactly telling you not to have sex. We discussed this with a few other topics, but it's better to be informed than to be told not to do it. Like Kevin was saying earlier, people are more inclined to do something if they're just told, no, you can't do this, you're not supposed to do this, that's bad, then instead of being informed so you know the right way to do it and the way to do it so that less harm is caused all the way around.
Well, we have a sheet here of all the different types of birth control, and if you'd like, we can pass it around and read one off each.
Yeah, we can do that.
So the first one is the implant. The healthcare provider places it under the skin of the woman's arm, and it lasts for 3 years. It's almost 100% effective. It only has a few side effects. Once in, there's nothing more to do. It does cause changes in your periods. After 3 years, have it taken out and have a new one put in.
The second one would be in IUC. The healthcare provider places it in the woman's uterus. There are two kinds, and they last 5 or 10 years. They're 99% effective. They have a few side effects, and once in, there's nothing more to do. They can cause some cramping when placed, and check the threads once a month.
Sterilization for men, the healthcare provider cuts or blocks the man's tubes. It's about 99% effective. It doesn't change the sex life, and it's a permanent thing that, you know, once it happens, it's there. It's been done. You can't really change your mind once you've done it. If you go and you get your tubes cut or blocked, then boom, that's the rest of your life. You have to give consent within 30 days or before, 30 days before you can go in and have it done. So you have 30 days to think about, okay, do I really want this done? And afterwards, you can get a sperm count to see if you really have any sperm left, so you know fully if it was extreme, if it was fully effective or not.
There's sterilization for women as well. It's cutting or blocking the tubes at, through the abdomen or cervix. It's about 99% effective. It does not change your sex life, and it's permanent. You cannot change your mind once it's been done, and there's consent must be signed 30 days ahead of time. Afterwards, you may need to get tested, but it's pretty much done.
These next ones are strictly for women. There's the shot, which was mentioned earlier as one of the most common forms of birth control. The healthcare provider gives the woman a shot every 12 weeks. It's about 94% effective. It's easy to use, and it causes light periods or no periods at all. Some of the cons, you may have some weight gain, which is understandable because of the change in hormones, and you get the shot only once every 12 weeks.
Another one would be the ring. The health provider prescribes it. Women put a new ring in their vagina once a month. It's 91% effective. It's easy to use. Must insert and remove the ring. You use the ring for 3 weeks and leave out for 1 week.
There's the patch, which is something I've never heard of until just a couple days ago at the presentation. The healthcare provider prescribes it, and women put on a new patch each week. It's about 91% effective. It's easy to use. The only cons of it are really that it may have a localized skin rash. And pretty much you change the patch on the same day of the week for 3 weeks in a row, and I think you're good.
There's the pill. It can... you have to take it daily. It's about 91% effective. Easy use, prevents cramps and heavy bleeding during periods. You have to take it every day at about the same day. It can help you schedule your periods.
So yeah, that's a bunch of information that I never would have heard of or I never would have known previously, and it's really a lot more stuff than I'd ever even have thought about. I never knew there were patches for pregnancy or shots for pregnancy or a ring or any of that stuff. It's brand new information to me. And while I'm a guy and I don't necessarily need to do it or use a lot of that stuff because most of it's located around or oriented toward the female, it's still good that if I have a friend that's like, hey, I don't know what to do for birth control, I can say, hey, there's all these different things. You could go and research it and find out what's most effective or whatever you would prefer the most. So now we invite you, the listening audience, to add to the ideas presented here today. We are open to your questions, comments, and insights. We are in the Willits studio, and our phone number is 707-456-9991. We only have a short time for this call-in portion of the show today, so please call soon. If you want to comment on youth and driving under the influence of alcohol, please do. What do you think about sex education in the schools? Is there enough? Should it be left up to the parents? If you are a parent, have you felt competent to educate your children about safer sex? How did you learn about sexual health? Did you have classes in school about it?
Do you think that sex education encourages early sexual activity? Do you know about resources in our community where youth can receive confidential and free services related to sexual health? At what age do you think that sexual activity is appropriate? Is our media responsible for making youth prematurely aware of sex? What advice would you give to youth about sexual health? The phone number is 456-9991. When you call, please be ready to turn down your radio or we'll get a very confusing echo. The number is 456-9991. Please call and be part of this discussion on sexual health and youth and drunk driving. Please call soon. This show will be over at 4 o'clock.
Caller, you are on the air. Caller, you are on the air. Okay, I guess they're not there. All right, caller, you're on the air. Caller? Okay, I guess too. Caller, you are on the air. Caller, are you there?
We seem to be having a little trouble with the phones here. Try calling again. It should actually just be working. Okay, try this. Caller, you're on the air. Can you hear me? You guys talk, and I will try and figure out what's up with the phones here.
All right.
Well, there were a few more options that we didn't discuss, so even the ones, there's still more. I mean, that was a loud beeping noise.
Okay, here we have the diaphragm. The woman goes to the provider, wants to be fitted. She uses it every time she has sex. It's 88% effective. It can be put in ahead of time, and it can be used again and again. However, it takes practice to learn how to use it. Helpful tips, use it with some spermicides, just in case.
Condoms for women. Women use a new condom every time she has sex. They're 79% effective. You can buy them in drugstores. They protect you from HIV and other sexual infections. It takes practice to learn how to put one in. And take your time putting it in.
The sponge. Women use a new sponge every time she has sex. It's about 76% effective. You can buy it in a drugstore, and you can put it in ahead of time. The only cons are that it's hard to take out sometimes. And some helpful tips would be to definitely keep some extra sponges on hand.
So, were your guys' parents comfortable talking to you about sex? Or if they didn't, if they did?
My parents talked to me about sex at a young age, and they were just like, okay, this is what sex is. You should be safe with it. It's up to you if you decide you ever want to have sex in your life. If you do or don't, or with a guy or a girl, it's entirely your choice. And I was told at like maybe 10 or 11, pretty much told, yeah, this is part of life, just be safe with it and you should be good.
I haven't had many talks with my parents about sex. Most of what I've learned has been through school and talk around the school or outside with friends, but my parents have always been a little bit, let's not really talk about that, you guys. That's kind of weird. You can learn with your friends.
Yeah, I was never really told anything about sex from my parents. It was all, I learned it from school, I learned it from my friends, I learned it from the internet. That's not surprising. I think the most talking I've gotten to was from my grandmother, and that was mostly just about pregnancy, because by the time she got to me, I was already 17, I already knew most of what I was going to know, and now it was just a matter of you being safe. Just don't get pregnant.
I learned about sex mostly from my sister and her friends, I guess, and from school. It wasn't until, like, a few years after my sister told me about it that my mom talked to me about it. I talked to my mom about everything, so we don't really have trouble discussing that kind of stuff. But my dad, on the other hand, was just like, no, you know.
We're not talking about this right now, ever.
Yeah, pretty much.
I think that it's probably a good idea for parents to talk to their kids about sex. Maybe not a lot, and maybe not super early, like it was for me, but I don't know, it worked for me, and I think that hearing it from my parents at a younger age was more informative for me and more helpful than hearing from teachers, hey, sex is dangerous, don't do that. It really, you know, hearing it from my parents, it made it a lot more personal and a lot more like information that I'd actually use one day, rather than just being told what to do and what not to do.
It's easier in school how they teach you the real risks, like STIs and pregnancy, versus your parents just telling you, you know, you're too young, don't have sex. They don't actually know, like, the information behind it, like the different STIs, my bad, that you can get from it.
And also, parents, surprisingly, or not surprisingly, depending on what position you're in, parent or child, have a hard time talking about sex. It's a very uncomfortable subject with, like, your child.
All right, so it seems like the phone isn't working at all, so I suppose we'll spend the rest of the time discussing the topics and hope that it's working next time.
So parents are a good source to go to for the basics, but the real risks are going to be found, like, information from somebody else. Go to the clinic, ask about it, because the doctor is going to tell you more than your parents might. And it's not like a true for everyone. I mean, I know there are some parents out there who really know how to get over the uncomfortableness of, like, talking about sex with their child, and they'll be able to go in depth and explain to you simply what it is you should and shouldn't be doing. But chances are it's going to become really uncomfortable. You're not going to want to hear it. They're not going to want to say it. And so the best place to go is to a confidential doctor-patient meeting and talk it through with someone who you don't really know, because it's easier to talk with someone about sex that you don't know versus someone you see every day, because that just gets a little awkward.
There's much less of a problem with judgment. A lot of people I know say, oh, I don't know, I would never tell my parents if I was sexually active. Or why? Because they're afraid of being judged by their parents. And who's afraid of being judged by a random doctor that won't tell anyone? I mean, there's not really much of a problem of judgment there. Whereas judgment is so rampant, especially in schools. I mean, you get judged for what you wear, so you're probably going to get judged for if you've had sex or not.
And who you've had sex with, if they find that out.
Yeah, exactly.
How many partners you've had, who. Yeah.
Also, if you talk to a doctor about it, they'll have more more information about it and more of the...
More of the facts.
The facts. Versus what your parents will... What they know and what they'll tell you.
It's likely to be more biased with your parents.
Yeah, either for or against. Some parents might want their kids to go out and have sex a lot. Some parents will probably want their kids not to have sex until they're 21 or till they're married or till they're out of the house. And then there are some parents that probably just, okay, go have sex if you want. Don't care. Don't tell me. I mean, you know, you never know.
I mean, there's also the factor of age difference, too, because parents, when they were younger and they were out, like, being sexually active, the birth control was different. Relationships, honestly, were different. A lot of the traditions in relationships, like, back then, maybe 10, 20, 30 years ago, are completely different from what we call the norm in our relationships. And so them giving us advice is actually advice from 20, 30 years ago that is completely different in our day and age, where dating is less of a commitment than it is like a fling.
There's also that STIs were a lot different back then than they are now. A lot of STIs maybe 20, 30 years ago might have been less common, and you wouldn't have really had to worry about it. Maybe you'd say, okay, I'm going to go and go find someone to sleep with. And you probably would think about birth control, but there's a pretty good chance you might not think, okay, let's try not to get any STIs or STDs back then. So now, whereas STIs and STDs are so common that you really have to think about it. You can't just say, well, she's not going to get pregnant, so there's no problem, is there? It can get passed from anyone to anyone through sexual contact, and it's really important to protect yourself or at least know what you're getting into so you're not needlessly harming the lives of others or yourself. It's one of the problems that I have with people, young people especially, drinking and having sex, is if you go out and you get drunk and you go and have sex, then you don't know what you're doing necessarily. You lose a lot of motor abilities and you lose a lot of the thoughts. You lose a lot of cognition. You stop being so thoughtful that you might not go and have sex with the person that you know has had sex with a lot of different partners. Or you might go and lose your standards and go have sex with anyone that's willing. There's also that having sex while drunk is, I believe, considered rape. If both parties are drunk, or if the woman is drunk and a guy were to have sex with them, then in an intoxicated or inebriated state, I'm pretty sure they're not legally saying yes. They might say yes, and they might mean yes, but because they're drunk, they could then say, oh wait, I was super smashed. I was hammered. I didn't know what I was saying. That was rape. And I personally know a couple people that have been charged with that without having any idea about it previously.
So gender could also affect, like, back to talking to your parents about it, I guess. Because if you're a guy and you're talking to your parents about sex, in most cases, it's completely different. Like, your dad could be encouraging you and be like, oh, yeah, go get them or whatever. Get some. But if you're a girl, your dad's like, no, don't. I don't even want you dating, you know. If you bring any guys home, I'm going to be sitting on the porch polishing my shotgun. I know I've heard that one.
That's all for this month's edition of Youth Speaks Out. Your hosts today have been me, Heaven,
Christina,
Rowan,
and Kelsey.
Laytonville Healthy Start Coalition's Drug-Free Communities Project is proud to support this month's Youth Speaks Out. Our Environmental Prevention Strategies in the Community, also known as EPIC, is project funded by the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Through our organization and coalition, we are working towards reducing youth substance abuse through a variety of strategies in the Laytonville community. If you are interested in learning more about our efforts, please contact Laytonville Healthy Start at 707-984-8089 or email Jama at jamashields@pacific.net.
Youth Speaks Out is produced and directed by Dan Roberts, who may be reached by mail at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490, or through the website www.youthspeaksout.net. There you can find out more information about the project, get addresses for contacting us, get a copy of a show, and listen to many hours of previous programs in Steaming Radio. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KZYX. They are the views of those who express them. Youth Speaks Out is aired on the first Sunday of each month. Our next show will be in 4 weeks. That is November 3rd at 3 p.m. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in November.